when you belong to God, when you are born again, the scriptures teach us that God expects that our lives change. And one of the ways our lives change is that we have what's needed to upgrade our vital relationships and bring change to our relationships. We don't just change our routines on Sunday mornings, so now we have a worship service to go to because we follow Jesus, and before we didn't. Also, we see that when God is at work transforming your life with new belief, you find that your relationships change with new behaviors. Paul writes about these new behaviors in the book of Ephesians chapter 4. Turn to Ephesians chapter 4. If you have a Bible with you, you can follow along. If you don't, we'll enable you to never bring it by putting these verses on the screen behind me. And Paul describes what happens when you belong to God. Something is changed in the way that you relate to people. The vital relationships that you have, God hasn't given us instructions on how to upgrade them in ways that are principled ways that include lots of grace. Our big idea today is that our new life in Jesus makes it possible to live among our church family in a new way. So however you lived among your family growing up, however you have interacted with other people's family, when you become a part of God's family, He changes the way that you deal with relationships. Your new life helps you to live among your church family in a new way. So you should be able to look back at your old life, the way you used to function with people, and see some change, because in our new life, there is new grace that works in our new relationships. In recent decades, churches who have changed are surviving. Churches that have not changed, as a general rule, are fading. And no matter what church family you've been involved with, if you're here now and have been a faithful church attender and member, you likely have endured lots of changes in recent years. In recent decades, our church family has changed in many ways. We have different, countless traditions that have changed. There's been countless transitions in leadership, and also you may have been a part of or aware of some of the tragedy that we faced in our church family as well. And over the years, one of the things that develops is lifelong friendships, that change kind of holds people together. It also helps people to kind of depend on one another, and it cements some relationships that become lifelong relationships. But wouldn't you imagine it's also true that with all kinds of change comes conflict? And in some cases, relationships aren't cemented together, they're wedged apart with conflict because of change and transitions, and also because of some of the painful tragedy. And when you live closely with people in a church family for decade after decade, you get to enjoy all of their charms, but you also get stuck with all of their quills and all of their prickliness sometimes. And so while there might be lifelong friends, sometimes what develops in a church family dynamic is lifelong adversaries, or people that you can be easily at odds with. I'm so grateful to tell you that even though change has troubled some of our North Central church family over the years, I'm happy to report that we don't have troublemakers. So people are troubled that it's changing and it's unfamiliar and it's different, but no troublemakers. And the reason is because there's spiritual maturity in the lives of some people who recognize the importance of being in unity and protecting that unity more than expressing ambitiously their preferences. The division and the dysfunction is visible in Washington, D.C. Anybody watch politics somewhat closely, and you could see the division and the dysfunction kind of eroding the fabric of our country. I'm sure people have felt the same over the decades and the centuries, but it seems palpable now that in our state capitals and in Washington, D.C., the division and dysfunction is doing damage. And I care about that kind of damage this much, but I care, I have a heartfelt investment in protecting the local church from dysfunction and from disunity. And being careful and attentive to my bigger concern, and that is that with our new faith, we don't bring with it old habits and old hurts that starts to erode the fabric of a church family that's unified together. Paul addresses this in Ephesians chapter 4, and he said that we can upgrade our relationships because church family relationships are a vital relationship. Now, you know how this works. In Ephesians chapter 1 through 3, Paul says, God becomes our father. He adopts us by our faith through his grace. He adopts us as his child. We join his household. He's our father. And look around. These are all your spiritual siblings, brothers and sisters, whether you like it or not. And he said that what happens is those who are separated, estranged, far apart, cut off, where aliens and foreigners have now been brought together, and they're all one big happy family, every tongue, tribe, and nation. And all of them, tongue, tribe, and nation, are to come together and protect the unity that was generated by the Spirit. The Spirit generates the unity, and the believers make every effort to protect it by binding ourselves together with peace. To upgrade our vital relationships, here's where we start. You've got this in your notes. Let me give you this fill-in. Here's where you start. And you might, if you're open to this, you are willing to contribute, if you are willing to make every effort to protect the peace and the unity of a church family, then you have a method by which you can do it. And it's simple. It's not science. It's not math. It's not equations. It's not formulas. Thank God. It's simple. Here it is. One principle of grace. Here's how you contribute to protecting the unity of a church family and protecting your relationships in a church family. Here it is. Priority three. You focus on your own flaws and forgive everyone else's. Focus on your own flaws and forgive everyone else's. Jesus was teaching this principle to his disciples, and he was making a contrast to the kingdom of the law, the righteous self-righteousness of the Pharisees, and his new kingdom that's upside down, it's backwards, it's the opposite of what you would expect it to be. And Jesus was teaching the difference between his kingdom and theirs. And he was saying the religious people spend their time looking at, focusing on, and pointing out the flaws of other people, which gives them the ability to elevate the righteousness of themselves and make sure everybody pays attention to how righteous they are. And he said, but in my kingdom, it's going to be different. You're not going to be able to notice the speck in other people's eyes because you're going to be distracted by the plank in your own eye. In other words, you won't even be able to worry about other people's flaws who have little flaws, because you're going to be consumed with identifying and treating and concerning yourself with your own flaws. Jesus is teaching that you begin with unity by paying attention, more attention to your own self-righteousness or your own failures and flaws. One of my favorite authors, Paul Tripp, writes it this way. It's sad but true that criticism, judgment, and condemnation in the face of the failure of others grows in the soil of self-righteousness. Our condemnation, judgment, and harsh treatment of other people for their failures and their flaws is growing out of the soil of self-righteousness. And Jesus is saying, in my kingdom, when you're born again, I've regenerated your heart and you belong to my family, you focus more on your own flaws than those of someone else. And when you do that, I mean, how many of you would admit it starts to add up and there's no real time or brain space left to worry about other people's? And the Spirit will certainly help bring those things to mind. So we keep peace in the church. How do we do this? What is this look like specifically? There's two things I want to point out that help us better understand how to do this. We find them right here in the scriptures in Ephesians chapter 4. And we'll start with this. You have a fill-in. Let your faith family have faults. Allow them to have faults. Be okay with the idea that other people are going to have faults. Just let them have them. They're theirs. They're not yours. You don't have to worry about theirs. You have your own. You can let them have faults. Now, look what he says, look how this happens. There's actually, he addresses the character here of the church family, mature believers, and here's what he says. Ephesians chapter 4, starting in verse 2. Always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other. And if you do, here's what you can do. You can make allowances for one another's faults, for each other's faults. So here's what happens. As you mature in your faith, you grow up, you grow a level of humility. In other words, there's a tenderness of heart. That humility gives way to patience. And in that patience, you, of course, have a gentleness in which you're dealing with people. And the result of that is you kind of let people off the hook for their own flaws. When you consider who are the most spiritual people in church, I'm pretty sure if I asked you that question interpersonally, I said, who are the most spiritual people in church? Probably what comes to mind is, well, it's clearly the leaders. I mean, if someone's been elevated to serve as a pastor or been elected to the deacon trustee board, or maybe someone who's been appointed as a ministry leader, or someone who's been teaching Sunday school a long time, anyone who teaches or leads Bible studies, people who initiate prayer, whatever, these are the most spiritual people. I'm not sure that that's true. Never forget that the teachers of the law in the New Testament were condemned. They were called names by Jesus. He insulted them regularly, and they were the longtime law keepers and teachers. The most spiritual people aren't the people who have attended the longest, who give the most, or who are the most faithful. What we see in Scripture is that mature believers express the humility, the gentleness, and the patience to show grace to other people who aren't perfect. And they're okay with that, and they're comfortable and confident that that's normal in a church family. The heavy work of helping to keep a church unified in peace is done by the mature believers who are humble, kind, gentle, and patient. So you, by the way, one of the things that happens when this is true, if you're humble and kind and patient, you stop talking about someone else's flaws because you're paying attention to the Spirit that is at work pointing out your own. And if you do that, you begin to hear the Spirit of God at work in you, helping you to stay in tune with your own flaws, and you genuinely don't have much to say about the flaws of others because you're talking to God about your own. And we can do so knowing that we have confidence when we approach God with our flaws and failures and we say, hey, God, I was slow to mention this, but I don't know if you've noticed, I have this flaw, this failure, and this sin. The joy and the freedom of a believer to do that is that God no longer counts our sins against us because of our faith and the grace that he shows us to expunge those sins so we can approach them and confess, no longer counting them against us. Secondly, you have number two in your notes here. If you purpose in your heart to let your faith family have faults, then the second thing that you consider here, according to the scripture text, is this. You let the Spirit fix yours. You let the Spirit fix yours. Let's read together verses 20 to 24. Ephesians 4, 20 to 24. But that isn't what you learned about Christ. See, you're a new believer. You have new life in Jesus. You learn something new. Since you have heard about Jesus and have learned the truth that comes from him, throw off your old sinful nature and your former way of life, which is corrupted by lust and deception. Instead, let the Spirit renew your thoughts and attitudes. Who renews your thoughts and attitudes, by the way? The Spirit. You don't effort to do that. Anybody ever got a whole lot of willpower into something and it fails? All the time, all of our life seems to, every time we get ready to kind of pull up our bootstraps and get ourselves ready, and this time we're going to lose weight, this time we're going to get fit, this time we're going to kick that habit, we're going to get over that hang up, we're going to stop thinking about that hurt, and we just will ourselves to it. How many of you start all over again the next day thinking, here we go again? Here we go again. When your mind and your attitudes change the way that the scriptures describe, it's a work of the Spirit, and we allow it to happen, but we should expect it to happen. The Spirit is at work in us, changing the way that we think about people and changing the way that we feel about them. Our thoughts and attitudes are renewed. And then he goes on in verse 24, put on your new nature, created to be like God, truly righteous and holy. So the question here is, have I demonstrated Christ-like change in growth in my thoughts and tone? If you're a maturing believer, it has something to do with your faithfulness, but it has more to do with your fruitfulness. And a part of the fruitfulness of a mature believer is this, that they notice a change in the way they think about their church family and the way that, I mean, Isn't it true that over time, when you're young, you love the law, but as you age, you start to enjoy the grace of God more and more? As we get more in touch with our own failures and flaws, and as we get, as you have more and more children who tell you how flawed you really are, you thank God for grace. And you enjoy that grace. But the Spirit is at work renewing me. I should see areas of thinking and attitudes that are changing over time compared to the way that I used to think about people and the way that I used to feel about people. And let me mention this. If you're young here and you haven't braced yourself for the failure of a mentor or a leader or someone that you love and respect who's older than you that you would see as a role model, in the church family, let me tell you, brace yourself for the failure and flaws to be exposed of your church leader, and let that not deter you or sabotage your faith. Let that remind you that God provides grace even to the people who are most publicly important in your life. They get the grace too. This message of the gospel is not a message of moralism and behaviorism. It doesn't mean that our primary message is if you believe Jesus, you will be flawless. You will live with high morals and never fall short of your own standards. Instead, it's a message of grace. But that's a work that the Spirit does to help us make every effort to throw off our corrupted old nature in order to put on our new nature. It's a throwing off and putting on. It's a clothing picture. We have to, probably like you, if you have children or grandchildren, we had to train our littlest ones that they had to take a shower, that showers are a real thing that real people have to take. It's not an option. You don't get to choose. I don't care that you took one last week. And a part of helping a child learn to take a shower is training, that this is something you do regularly. You have to do it. You have to kind of get out of that slimy skin and put on some new skin. And then there's a second part of the training. And I'll never forget, I could still see my wife when she realizes that the little guys took their shower and then got out of the shower and put their old slimy clothes back on. And she says, "How long have you been wearing that? You're supposed to change. You didn't say change. You said get in the shower. I got in the shower." There's two steps. Clean your body. Put on new clothes. Don't think that there's any difference as we take on the character that God has provided for us. We take off the old, and the Spirit does a new work in our hearts with new thoughts, new attitudes. But we have to work at putting on the new clothing. You cannot, as adults, we pay special attention, don't we, to change the clothes after the shower. Change the clothes, special attention, because we know how important it is not to find ourselves with new, fresh, refreshed, clean skin that's covered in stinky old clothes. We're very familiar with that. This is true for our character as well. We have to be very, very attentive that we have a new, renewed skin and we have a refreshed heart, and it is unfitting. It should make us cringe at the idea that we're putting new or old character, old stinky character on a new heart. And it should, in fact, inspire us to have the same kind of response. When we do that as mistakes, I mean, we put on that new clothing as a mistake, there's a reaction, and that reaction is to replace it with a new. And here's what I want you to see here. The one of the very clear steps here in letting the Spirit fix your flaws is this. And when you're replacing your corrupted old clothes with new ones, there are four old clothes that Paul addresses head on here. And here's what he says. One of the old clothes is lies. We are able to throw off the lies and replace the lies with something else. And here's what he says, replace your distortions, which is lies, it's distorting the truth, with honest straight talk. So when you are functioning among believers in the church family, we have to throw off distorting the truth. And most of us aren't bold-faced liars, right? I mean, when you think about your time spent with church family, it's probably not one lie after another. But there's a kind of a unique way that we find ourselves lying without intending to, and it starts as simple as distorting the truth. And anytime you distort the truth to make yourself look better and maybe discredit somebody else, that's the lie that Paul's talking about, that we have to replace that distortion with honest, straight talk. And anytime we shade, distort, or otherwise find ourselves exaggerating, slanting the truth to make ourselves look better, we, in so doing, we make someone else look bad, and that fails to protect the unity of the church family. And it's one of our very vivid ways that we get to throw off the old and to put on the new. Second is anger. Anger. So many people, I think, believe that they're free from anger because it doesn't control them to the extent in which they lose their temper. If you have a short fuse and you find yourself erupting in anger, but you're able to kind of control it from full eruption, or you might find yourself with a long fuse, not often prone to erupting in anger, but you might also think that because that's true, anger doesn't control you. Here's what Paul teaches us. Paul teaches us that anger controls you if you erupt and lose your temper and you say and do abusive things and painful things that hurt people. That's one way that anger controls you. But there's another way anger controls you too, and that is that you don't let it find relief, you don't put it to rest, you don't resolve it or reconcile before you go to sleep. And so people who are blowing up, anger controls them. People who are smoldering at night when the sun goes down, anger controls them. And this is the only old clothing, the old corrupt clothing that Paul says, you have to be especially careful with this one, because when you let anger smolder overnight and then nights become days and days become weeks and weeks become months and years, you give a foothold to the devil and the enemy, and he says that the enemy begins to destroy your life through the foothold of anger. And so what he says is, that when you throw off the old and put on the new, you're replacing your smoldering anger with a quick release, finding a way by God's grace to let anger be released before you go to sleep. Some people say that that simple truth right there has helped preserve their marriage for decades. And it would, in fact, we recognize that when we learn to control our anger, instantly, we don't give control of ourselves to it. So much anger has been done by thoughtless, mindless reactions. And, you know, you might save yourself some conflict by resolving anger and deciding you're not going to explode anymore. But when you resolve the smoldering anger, you are able to, if you find a way to release that anger, you are able to save yourself from burning your entire life down, because smoldering ashes eventually burn something down. So it may not explode with instantly, but smoldering anger certainly does long-term damage. So the question is, have I learned to control my anger, or does my anger control me? And the scriptures teach us that we address our anger every night. Some of you are thinking, you know, my prayer list, Pastor, I pray through this prayer list. It's so long, and I'm praying for every... Make sure you write in your prayer list, face, address, and use grace today to bring relief to my anger. And some of you will find that a practical way to deal with it. Thirdly is theft. Theft. Paul says that one of the ways that the church body faces danger and is damaged is that there are some people among the body who are taking and sponging. Able-bodied, able to work people who aren't working, they aren't providing for themselves. Instead, they're borrowing and not returning. They're taking instead of giving, and they find themselves doing damage to the body because they're sponging and taking. And Paul says you want to replace that, and you're replacing that with, if you're able, you work, you provide for your needs, and if you keep working, you'll have enough to join the church family in adding generosity to the church and bringing peace and soothing these relationships that can be distressed. And then number four is words. Words can be a weapon or words can be ointment to bring healing, a weapon to hurt or an ointment to heal. And we know as well as anybody how fast and how quick our heart speaks, and those words are like weapons and they do damage and they actually cause harm. But Paul is saying that you replace that with new clothes that help us to use our words as ointment that brings encouragement, that everybody who hears them is uplifted and encouraged and strengthened because we're using our words to add healing to our relationships and to our church family. So if we're born again, if we're a real gospel church, there will be one glowing telltale sign. When people are in and among our church family, there is one way that we can stand out as a loving church to help recognize or help identify us as this is a gospel church, and here it is. We are serious about cleansing our toxic relationships with forgiveness. We deal with relationships that are toxic one way, and that one way is we forgive people for all kinds of rage, all kinds of anger, harsh words, slander, all kinds of evil behavior and bitterness. We replace that. We do something different. We detox our church by being kind to each other, tender-hearted, and ultimately by forgiving one another. And by the way, some of you have bought carbon monoxide sensors, right? You've plugged them in. They're in your house. Maybe they're working. Maybe they're not. You only find out when you're dead if they're actually working. But you've got them plugged into your house, and here's the idea, that you want a red alert notification that there's something toxic in the air in your home. Paul is teaching us here that there is a toxicity that happens in our relationship, and it's this: harshness, rudeness, bitterness, rage, anger, slander, all types of evil behavior brings poison and toxicity to our relationships. And Paul says, God is teaching us that in the church of Ephesus, as a gospel church, here's how that's all resolved. You resolve that by forgiving one another. It should never get to the point where it's boiling over with these kinds of behaviors, all kinds of evil behaviors. Instead, we're dealing with this with grace. Now, how do we do that? How do we replace the poison with kind-hearted forgiveness? How do we treat poisonous relationships with the kind of forgiveness that detoxes and brings healing? Especially if there's someone, and you might say, Pastor, I mean, I can see that if you kind of have some bumps and bruises from people, but you got to understand, there's people I loathe. They have hurt me. They have hindered my life in dramatic ways or noticeable ways. They have harmed me and my family. How can I possibly do this? Here's what Paul says. Just like Jesus forgave you. Same way. What does that mean? How did God through Jesus forgive me? Well, he recognizes that your sins are separating you from him. And he provided for you in your mountain of sin and failure and harshness and any of the hurts you've caused to other people or any of the sins you've committed against God. That whole mountain of sin, God has provided enough grace to wash it away. To wash it away so that it is there's no record of it. He's washed it as far as the east is from the west. He took all of that mountain of sin and he put it in the sea of forgetfulness. He doesn't remember it. He expunges it from your record. You are no longer, from that point on, able to treat anybody in any other way except to give them some of the grace that you've received. Some of the grace. And listen, if you have a forgiveness issue with somebody, you don't primarily have a problem with someone else's sin. You primarily have a problem with your own sin against God that he's treated with grace and you're forgetting or minimizing or somehow marginalizing. And I mean, here's how Jesus described it. He said, I tell you, this woman's sins, they are many, but she's been forgiven of these many, many sins. So she has shown me much love. Listen to this. But a person who is forgiven little, the person who can't forgive, the one who's only kind of forgiven a little tiny doses, is certainly a person who loves me, Jesus, just a little bit. In other words, to the degree in which you recognize the mountain of forgiveness is the degree in which you express a mountain of love for the forgiver himself. And that forgiveness spills over into every person who's hurt you, every person who's hindered you, and every person who's eventually done life-altering damage to you. Is it easy? No. But the only way to identify ourselves as a One of the primary ways to identify ourselves as a church family with vital relationships is to upgrade it with some grace. And that's how it works. Paul Tripp, favorite author, teacher, he says it this way. You'll see it on the screen behind me. People who are broken and grieved by the depth of their own sin tend to look on the sin of others with compassion and grace. And if you find yourself in this situation where your relationships that you have with somebody have been damaged and you have a hard time letting it go, and here's the instructions of the scriptures, God would say, pay closer attention to your own flaws and forgive them for theirs. And you will find all the grace that you could possibly need to continue to live in my love and my tenderness that I've expressed to you. Let's pray together. Father, thank you today for our church family.